Hi everyone. Welcome to the last session before lunch. This session will be all about storage, software-defined storage from Microsoft. We will have a quick recap on the actual stack in software-defined storage in 2012 R2, and of course we will have a overview of all the new features coming up.
But before that, maybe
let me introduce Carsten Rachfall.
Hi, I'm Carsten Rachfall, Hyper-V MVP from Germany, and you are?
I'm from Switzerland, working at IDnetics and the Cloud Data Center MVP, and I'm, as Carsten, I'm doing a lot of storage projects, either classical SAN and, of course, a lot of storage spaces related stuff. And this will be covered in this session, so we will have all the new features coming up in 2016. We will have a quick overview, and of course, all the live demos will work smoothly, so we can go to lunch after a great session, hopefully. Demo gods, please be with us, and we will start with, let's say, the current stack in 2012 R2. Our daily base on software-defined storage.
Yeah. Please give me the clicker.
This is
Thank you. So first, quick show of hands. Who is using scale-out file server with 2012 R2? OK, a few, maybe 10% or less. Scale-out file server with storage spaces? OK. Scale-out file server with traditional block storage? Who is using that? Someone here? Okay. So you are familiar with the stuff we are talking about now. The others, Microsoft started with Windows Server 2012 to the software-defined storage journey, and there was big improvements in Windows Server 2012 R2, and there will be even more in Windows Server 2016. So let's recap what is in Windows Server 2012 R2. We are only talking about storage spaces here, but you see here some JBots with, these are ZAS JBots, shared ZAS JBots. If you see JBots, you can substitute them for block storage. So everything with a scale-out file server is also working with block storage. If you have some fiber channel ZAN or iSCSI ZAN, you can use those storage devices with scale-out file server as well. But when we look at the software-defined storage stack from Microsoft, we have our JBots. On top of the JBots, there are some servers sharing these JBots. So every server has one or more connections to every JBot. We usually, Michael, we do redundant connections to the JBot, so every storage node has two connections to every JBot. In this scenario, every storage node has six connections to the three JBots. And here are four nodes. We often do deployments with only two nodes, and you can have up to 240 disks in such a deployment. So on top of that, you have your storage node, you have your ZAS devices, your shared ZAS devices. We create a storage pool. Every disk are put in the pool, and you can have up to four pools in a high available scale-out file server scenario. When you have your pool, you carve out of your pool virtual disks or storage spaces. I often tell the people, this is like a LAN in a block storage scenario. So you said, here's my pool or my pools. Please give me a 10 terabyte storage space, virtual disk, LAN. When you have these LANs, you can do everything you can do with other disk devices in Windows. So you create a volume on this LAN or on this virtual disk, and you can do NTFS in this volume, you can do ReFS, and use it as every other storage. And then we put a file server on top of these storage spaces, and then we can use it from Hyper-V nodes, from SQL, and so on. This is called the software-defined storage system, and to use The file server, you have to use a protocol. It's called SMB3. There are also some different versions. With 2012, we got SMB3.0. With 2012 R2, there was SMB3.02. And with 2016, we will have SMB3.1.1, if this
point something.
Point something. So, and with every SMB protocol new version, there are new features also in the SMB protocol. Next slide. This is a software-defined storage stack in Windows Server 2012 R2. After starting in Windows 2012, Microsoft added in 2012 R2 something like tiering. So you can now have in your storage space HDDs and SSDs, and the system builds a heat map when you use the storage and moves blocks that are often used to the SSDs, and blocks that are not so often used are in the HDDs. And it's working quite well. We did a lot of implementations, even bigger ones with nearly a petabyte of storage. And there is a price advantage if you do that. Yeah? But be aware, last year we did a session about storage spaces best practices or session learned. There is a lot of learning with storage spaces. And I would strongly advise, if you do storage spaces, find a partner who has done those implementations before, because it's a very new technology. We are now in version 2. And Satya Nadella says something at an event in Berlin. When Microsoft has done the third version of a software, it's rock solid. So the third version will be Windows Server 2016.
I mean, it's already solid. Otherwise, we would quit our job, right?
Okay. So what we hear from customers about storage, the software-defined storage stuff.
What do you hear from customers?
I know the slides. It is the same. So when I talk to customers, they said, oh, storage spaces direct. This is very local. You can have it in one rack. You have your servers directly connected with SAS cables to the JBots. They want something else. They have two data centers. Of course, they want...
They want storage replication.
Yes.
We don't have that right now. On the storage level, we don't have it. Point. If we want to replicate, there is one scenario, of course, for virtual machines. It's Hyper-V Replica, orchestrated by Azure Site Recovery or by your own runbooks, however. This is something which is really missing, actually, block-level replication on the storage level. And the second thing was always, Microsoft doing storage? Are you serious? Are you kidding me?
Yes.
I mean, the whole Azure platform in the public cloud is running on software-defined storage from Windows, basically. So, I mean, the question is clear why it comes up, why it pops up, but we can definitely say this is not an issue anymore. We do trust in storage from Microsoft. Of course, and as Carsten said, we also have a lot of productive implementation, not only lab stuff. Everything is working in lab, of course,
Michael,
but
let
also
me,
production.
Let me add something. This is true. I hear from a lot of customers, we don't trust Microsoft as a storage vendor. But I also see the opposite. Oh, Microsoft is doing storage. Let's grab some stuff, put it together, and use it. And that's also a very... we see that approach a lot, and it's... of course, not working that way. Grab your stuff together and work with it. We saw a lot of problems with that.
I mean, this is definitely not plug and play. You have to choose the right components, the right this, the right firmware levels, whatever. And that's, I mean, if you do it right, then it's working, of course, as any other storage solution. This is a favorite one, right?
I think
can you do the same thing as I can do with my Nutanix box?
No.
Oh, then you crap.
But maybe in the future.
Yes.
So this
is a big point right now. Yeah, can we do this? No, we don't.
Yeah. Who wants to do hyperconverge? Is it also a buzz for you? Okay. So hyperconverge, what is hyperconverge, Michael?
Hyperconverge is basically running compute and storage on the same box. Scale it out on a per node level. So software and network between, no shared storage, local storage with the hypervisor in the same box. That's basically VMware vSAN or EvoRail. That's Nutanix. All the stuff you already know, of course.
And that will be Microsoft, of course.
Yeah.
Okay.
And why are you doing... No, just leave that behind.
I think there is, of course,
a use case
yeah. for hyperconverged, but not everything is. There is not always a nice price point for hyperconverged.
I mean, the problem is basically your storage layer may not scale at the same level as your compute layer. So if you need more storage and you're doing hyperconverged, you have to add memory and CPU just because everything is in one box. May not be the use case for a larger scenario, of course, because the two levels don't scale at the same speed, mostly.
Yeah. So let's come to the new great stuff, storage replica.
Storage replica. This fills a gap we are faced in every project. And it's not backup. Storage replication is not backup. It's just a preparation for your disaster. It's being prepared for your disaster. It's being prepared for a big move to another data center if you have a planned power outage, whatever. And I can't say this enough again. It's not backup. It's just a replication of the current state. So if you're doing crap in data center A, this crap is immediately replicated to data center B. So this is what it's used for, disaster preparation. And storage replica is based in Server 2016. It's built in. It's block level. And the most important thing, it's hardware agnostic. So any volume type you choose can be replicated to the destination volume. Doesn't matter if it's a SAN volume. Doesn't matter if it's a volume coming from storage space. Doesn't matter if it's either a local volume with a single machine you can replicate to another machine with a local hard disk. We use SMB3 as a transport protocol for replication with all the advantages you get from RDMA, low latency, high throughput. And we manage it via PowerShell or cluster administrator, or at the later stage with Azure Site Recovery. So storage replica, as I said, is operating on the, let's say, between partition and volume layer. That's because you can have every type of volume as a source as well as a destination. Of course, there are some points to look at. We will see the requirements in a later slide. So source, destination can be async or synchronous replication. If we talk about the scenarios, this is one, stretch cluster. What can we use that for? Let's say maybe for a virtual file server cluster stretched over two data centers, and you want to do failover without shared storage being in just one data center, that's the use case. So your storage is asymmetric, so the nodes in data center A, they have a shared storage, and node in data center B have their own shared storage, and you're replicating between the four nodes, basically the two volumes across each other cluster. Each other cluster node, sorry. It's one cluster shared across data centers. The replication is synchronous only, so this scenario does not support asynchronous replication and has an automatic failover. Nothing to do if data center A goes down, the volumes come up automatically in data center B. Cluster to cluster, we have two clusters, each in one data center. That is what we basically have right now with the storage spaces projects, two data center, two storage stamps, replication occurs on Hyper-V level. But here, you can replicate volume across two data centers, across two clusters, either synchronous or async, of course. The failover is manual, so you, as an administrator or storage admin, you have to decide, now I'm doing a failover, or now I'm doing a switchover. I mean, switchover is a planned failover, in fact. You have to do that manually. You can do server to server, single node to single node, synchronous or asynchronous, manual failover as well. Now, the synchronous failover is the same as with every other storage solution. You write an I/O with your application in data center A, or let's say on site A. The I/O is written to a lock disk. Lock disk is an SSD disk in the cluster, or visible to the cluster. And the I/O is sent to the destination, also staged to the lock disk. If it reaches the lock disk, the commit comes back to node A, to application A. So you have, for every I/O, you have three I/Os, in fact. And that's why you lose 2/3 of your performance. With every storage solution you replicate in synchronous, you lose performance, of course. But it's synchronous, zero data loss, block level. And as the I/O has been committed to both lock disks, it's destaged to the, let's say, real volume where the data lives. So the bigger your lock disk is, the more you can survive an outage between the two sites. Does that make sense? So if you have a small lock disk and it gets full, then you're not able to, let's say, replay the logs after the connection between two data centers is reestablished. So lock disk size is a planning thing. Plan your lock size accordingly to your SLAs. So the asynchronous workflow is all the same as the synchronous workflow, except one fact. The commit for the application layer comes back if the EIO has been written to the lock disk on the source side. And then the EIO is transferred over the wire to the site B. How many data loads you have? Nobody can say. Is it 1 second? Is it 500 milliseconds? Is it a half a minute? Something you can't say. There's a best effort, of course, which is usually below 30 seconds, usually below 10 seconds, but it's depending on your network throughput, your latency, the physical distance of your both sites, of course. So the difference here is the I/O completes as it reaches the source lock disks and doesn't wait for being committed to the destination lock disk. What are the requirements for storage replica? Any volume, as I said. For synchronous replication, you have to be below 5 milliseconds of round trip between the two sites. Theoretically, it could be more than 1,000 kilometers, but then you would have to live in outer space. In real life, it's somewhere between 30 and 40 kilometers. Could you go above the 5 milliseconds? Yeah, sure, you could. But then your performance will drop down at the level which is, let's say, almost useless. Identical size for source and target volume. You can't have a 5 terabyte volume here as a source and a 2 terabyte as a target. That's pretty clear. SSDs for lock disks is not a requirement, but it's recommended, of course, because there the speed happens between the replication nodes. Identical physical sector geometries. Of course, you cannot replicate a volume which is based on 512 emulated block disks against the native 4K block disks, but that's also not really surprising. Yeah. There is a storage replication write ordering, so if you have distributed applications like a SQL databases living on different volumes, you want to have the write ordering being kept while replicating the data to the destination. So it doesn't mess up with your logical write ordering on the source application. That's also built in. So now we're going to have a quick view how easy it is to enable a cluster-to-cluster synchronous replication. What you can see here is a failover cluster manager with one cluster, the CL01 and CL02. Both consist of two nodes. They don't have shared storage between the clusters, of course, because it's not possible. We have, on the source side, we have a cluster shared volume and a lock disk. Why cluster shared volume? Just because on top of that, you have a scale-out file server role, which needs the disk to be a cluster shared volume. On the destination side, we also have a scale-out file server, and we have as well a cluster shared volume and the log disk. You can see the sizes here. I just created a small one, so it doesn't take forever to replicate the initial stage. Now, this scenario, actually, in TP3 is, I mean, TP3, technical preview 3 of Server 2016, which is publicly available since last week, is only possible in PowerShell. So I'm not gonna type the command in. I'm not going to do a live code example. It's just I'm going to execute new SR partnership, a specified source computer, which is of course the cluster, the resource group name, source volume, source log volume, and of course the stuff at the destination. I provide the synchronous replication mode, and I define the log size bytes as 10 gigabytes, and it's just executing this command. Now, if we look at the destination, in some seconds, you should see the result. Quick look at the source side. It's finished. Command has finished. Now, if I do a refresh in failover cluster manager, I pray so it does not crash. It's still there. And we have a replication going on. We have a synchronous replication going on. The status is initial block copy. Of course, the source blocks have to be copied to the destination volume. As its block size, it has no clue what's on the volume, so it copies each block after each block to the destination volume. This takes, in the lab here, this takes about 5 to 10 minutes, and then it's synchronous. After this point, you can switch the replication direction. You can do a manual switch over, or you can have a failover if side A goes down. Then you have to manually take the destination volumes online. So it's easy as that, and it's rock stable. As you know from your, let's say, existing storage solution, that's not a lot to do with it. Either it's in sync or it's async, and you can do switchovers. Any question on how this works so far with replication? Then we move on to
RFS.
RFS, yes. RFS, Carsten, is it a file system which we can use now, or are we not?
Yes, you can use it now. It's in Windows Server 2012 R2, and it will be even more important in 2016. In my opinion, there will be a shift from NTFS to RFS very soon. It's a new file system. NTFS has, when NTFS was built, I think they can't imagine that you use larger volumes than 256 gigabyte, but there are companies out there that have a lot of storage, and one advantage of RFS is you can have a big file system on a LAN or on a storage device. But there are even more advantages. RFS is rock solid. We have checksums for the metadata. So if some bits are changing on your devices, RFS can detect that and auto-correct that. And RFS with storage spaces is even better because it's working under the covers with storage spaces. I think it's on another slide. So Very important, metadata has always a checksum. So metadata is the file system has to know where are the blocks for the files, for example. And if there is something going wrong with the metadata, you can't use your whole file. And this can't be imagined, for example, a VHDX for an hypervisor with a SQL server in it, and you have maybe 10 terabytes of data, and your metadata is corrupted, you can't get to your VHDX anymore, can't use the data in there. So this is very important that ReFS has a protection for that. You can even enable checksums for user data. So the metadata is protected, but your user data by default is not protected by ReFS. But you can enable that. Of course, there is a performance impact if you enable checksumming for the normal user data. Healing detection and corruption, I talked about that a little bit. So for example, if we have a three-way mirror with ReFS, we have three disks where our data is spread over the three disks. We have every block is on three disks, and one block is corrupted. ReFS always checks the checksums when it reads data. But of course, it is possible you store data in your file system and you don't use it for months. So if there is a corruption, ReFS wouldn't know of those this corruption. And there is also a scheduled task, I think it's called scrubbing or so. It's checking, I don't know, do you know how often it's done?
No, to be honest.
It's done automatically in the file system, so a ReFS file system is also checked if the blocks are correct, if there are some checksum errors. You showed the demo?
Yeah,
maybe you give me the clicker.
No.
No, give me the clicker, please.
You want to reshow the demo?
In this demo, we have a bad block on disk one. ReFS is working with storage spaces and knows there are other blocks, mirror blocks of this block, and it can copy the block onto the defect block. So it regenerates the resiliency in ReFS.
Which leads, in fact, to the next slide, because ReFS is designed to be online every time. So what's the biggest issue?
So I go to the next slide.
Yeah, please. What's the biggest issue if you have, let's say, a 40 terabyte cluster shared volume formatted with NTFS? And let's say at one point of time you want to do, or you have to do, checksumming, let's say, check disk.
Like a check disk.
Like a check disk.
Okay.
40 terabyte volume check disk.
It was a nightmare in Windows 2008 R2. It was really a nightmare.
It took forever and
forever,
one day.
Days, maybe weeks.
Yeah. Now it's better, but it's still an issue. So if you have a 100 terabyte cluster shared volume, then you don't want to take this offline and do a check disk against it. So ReFS has to stay online all the time while being fixed if getting partially corrupted. And this is happening under the hood automatically. That was the main goal for ReFS at the first stage, to have a file system which can scale up to yottabytes.
It's I don't know.
I don't even know how many zeros it's.
I don't know exactly. Exabytes.
And to be online all the time.
Yeah. Online repair, online volume backup of critical data, and we have. This is very great. I'm a Hyper-V MVP, and I see everything from Hyper-V. So we have some great features for Hyper-V. You will demonstrate them later. So for example, if you do a snapshot in Hyper-V.
Checkpoint.
I use snapshot. You have to slap me now. Checkpoint, of course. The new name is Checkpoint. If you do a checkpoint in your system, the great news, we will talk about that tomorrow and what's new in Hyper-V 2016. We have now production checkpoints, but I use checkpoints now in my production. I know this is not supported, but I think everybody is using checkpoints in some way, and even the system is using checkpoints. So if you do a Hyper-V replica,
I mean, yeah.
It uses checkpoints under the cover. If you do a host-based backup in Hyper-V, it's using checkpoints under the cover.
What's the main issue with checkpoints?
Oh, you have to merge the data. If you delete the checkpoint, you have to merge the data together. The changed blocks have to be merged into the disk.
So let's do a little question out there. How many of you had already an issue with a virtual machine running on a checkpoint and having gigabytes of data in the differential disk files. Almost everyone.
No, it's almost not every hand, but they are maybe not using Hyper-V. Huh?
It doesn't matter if you're using VMware or Hyper-V. This problem exists all over the virtualization platforms. Somebody thinks that this is a replacement for backup, or he does take a checkpoint before installing patches,
yeah.
And if he forgets to delete it, and the checkpoint exists for months, and then you're up.
Doomed, yeah.
So this...
Please show us what's great, or please show the animation first. Huh?
Yeah, this is the theory here, so you can see a child VHDX file, or let's say a differential disk file, which has to be merged into the parent VHDX file as you delete the checkpoint, right? And if this is hundreds of gigabytes of data, this takes forever and forever.
Because
and
every byte from the child VHDX has to be copied into the parent VHDX,
yeah.
And this takes time. If you have some gigabytes there, it takes time. And with ReFS, there actually is no copying of data anymore. Because the ReFS file system knows the pointers to the blocks, and it's like a mater operation. And Michael will show us that in...
So, let's say we have a virtual machine. Has a checkpoint. Now the interesting part is how big the checkpoint is. It must be around 15 or 16 gigabytes. I created the checkpoint and then I copied some crap data into the virtual machine just to demonstrate. The size of the checkpoint, it's around 16 gigabytes, right?
16 gigabytes, okay.
So now we're going to delete the checkpoint.
And the virtual machine is running on a ReFS file system, huh?
Virtual machine is running on a scale-out file server with storage spaces direct with ReFS as a file system.
Okay.
Yeah. Merge in progress. So how long would that take to merge 16 gigabytes of data on my crappy lab storage at home? Usually. I mean, forever.
A lot of minutes.
It's almost finished. I'm not finished with talking. Yeah. It's done.
Maybe show the disks again?
No, because it may not work.
Yeah.
Ah, it worked. It's now, the parent disk file is now merged with the child VHDX we had. So imagine the backups you were doing with either Veeam or DPM, whatever tool you're using. The main issue is, if you have a lot of changes during the backup phase of a virtual machine inside the guest OS, like a data inject is going on, this is a major issue, to merge the checkpoints after the backup is finished at the host level. Yeah. So this solves a lot of problems, not only for forgotten checkpoints.
I think we have some scenarios on the slides.
Yeah, we have another cool stuff with ReFS, which is, in fact, who is using fixed VHDX?
So instead you specify of dynamically how large your
VHDX. Who is using fixed size hard disks? One, two.
Oh, there are five, six. So
why?
What's happening
why
if you
are using fixed? Why? Who is using fixed because of, let's say, performance? No one. Cool. That's cool because this is. So you don't want a thin provision?
Yeah.
Okay, so
it's
monitoring
growing
of thin
and
provision.
Sometimes your virtual machines are on hold because there's no space left on your storage device. This can happen with dynamic disks. With fixed disks, you know how much they consume and it's there. So, and how long it takes to create a 100 gigabyte fixed disk on an NTFS file system, it takes a while because every block is zeroed out. So the system is writing a lot of zero blocks onto your storage system. If you have ODX for that, that's great. It's very fast, but normally you get a 100 gigabyte file with zeros in it. In ReFS, zeros is not a problem.
No, because the blocks are not really zeroed out on the file on the user data level. It's just marked as used blocks at the metadata level. Yeah. So this animation here, I mean, VHDX and REFS is already finished, and the NTFS version does take forever. I'm going to show you, because otherwise I didn't believe it when I saw it the first time.
Yeah.
So let's do an example here. I'm on a Hyper-V host 2016, and I'm going to create a new VHDX. On my scale-out file server, demo large cool VHDX with the size of, let's say, 100 gigs. And of course, I have to provide the fixed parameter. So it creates a fixed VHDX. Now, we're going to measure that. Measure command code.
No, cook command is it isn't.
You should not live code. That's always. Measure command for this creation of the new VHDX. Let's give it a hit. Boom. 1.7 seconds for a 100 gig.
And it doesn't matter how large your fixed VHDX is on RFS.
Usually, we have a big applause here at the moment.
You can do a 100 terabyte disk in this speed. Okay, there's another advantage.
Yeah.
Because if you use dynamic disks, if you don't use fixed disks, you use dynamic disks, if a disk is extended, it's also zeroed out. So if you use dynamic disks with your virtual machines, there's always an extension happening, and there are some zeros written onto the system. And therefore, RFS is also very fast. Was this a question? Maybe. We don't know.
You could be absolutely right.
Yeah.
At the moment, it looks like this will be the fact.
But we really don't know. We think so, but we don't know. And you can't boot from VFS, so you still have to use.
Yes, we don't have it here. We can do that offline. Yeah. Of course, there are some features missing in REFS, like dedupe. Deduplication does not exist at the moment for REFS.
But we hope it will
there
be there.
There are other things, but I would say there are not things really important for classical server virtualization storage, which is actually missing right now. It's more in the file server data level where some features are still missing. Yeah.
So we have not so much time here left for that, but we have a side session tomorrow, I think at 3:45 in Miami. We will tell you about that in a slide. So we will discuss there storage spaces direct, RFS, and storage rebalancing. We have more time there. So
I mean, we have the early morning discussion on Wednesday, right?
I hope it's Wednesday, not tomorrow.
It's Wednesday.
After the party.
It's Wednesday.
Great. Okay. There's also an early morning discussion where you can ask us.
Yeah, and we can show you all the details, of course, offline if you want to join the early morning or the side session.
And we have the Ask the Expert tomorrow at 6 p.m. I think it's tomorrow, 6 p.m., where we are at the Ask the Expert. And another file system and storage MVP will join us.
I mean,
you can come there and ask us questions.
We have 20 minutes now. That should be sufficient for the last two topics.
Three. Quas?
Three. Two and a half.
Two and a half. No, that's very important.
What is storage quas for? Quality of service for storage. Why should I use that? What's the matter?
If you have a noisy neighbor, so imagine on your
You're looking at me as a noisy neighbor.
I'm the noisy. Oh, yeah, of course. So you have your virtual machines running, and someone is starting a virtual machine that consumes a lot of IOs. Because maybe he's testing disk speed in there. He has a virtual machine, and he tries to get everything of your system. So it would be nice to have that you can limit the I/O of such a machine. And this was possible is possible with 2012 already, 2012 R2. But in Windows 2016, there will be additional features, and these are really great.
Yeah, because now you can limit you can cap the max IOPS on a virtual disk level. per virtual machine per disk. There is a minimum level, which does not work, but you can cap the max level of per virtual
machine. In 2012
or two. In 2012 or two.
But let's talk about 2016.
It's not centrally manageable, yeah.
And let's talk about 2016.
We have to have a central view. As he said, we have to mitigate the noisy neighbors, and we have to monitor it. Which tenant, or let's say which virtual machine, is using how much performance and why on which disks. So we can deploy a level of service at the storage layer for our customers. I mean, if I pay for 10,000 IOPS and I only get 500, I won't be happy. So we have to monitor it and we have to control it. So now with this version of Windows Server, you can control the storage QoS policy centrally, either through PowerShell or through Virtual Machine Manager, centrally. Yeah, and the policies are enforced by the soft cluster, right?
Yeah, there is a policy manager. And when you install a Windows Server 2016 scale-out file server, you have this already. So the measurement of the IOPS is already there. It's a great feature, and I did an interview with Jose Barreto and Sentil on the Ignite conference, and they said they will even bring this storage cross if you have block storage. So if you have Hyper-V in front of a fiber channel storage or a iSCSI storage, you will get storage cross. It's not dependent on the scale-out file server. It's already in the scale-out file server in TP3, but it will also be in a pure Hyper-V cluster. There will be the measurement, the guarantee, and so on. There are some great policies you can do. You can do min mode. No, not min mode. It's the single instance mode and the multi-instance mode. In fact, you can also combine VMs from one customer and say, give this customer 5,000 IOPS. And they will share. All the VMs of the customer will share the IOP limit. For example.
I mean, on Azure, if you create a virtual machine with a single disk, you got 500 IOPS. A lot of people don't know that. Yeah. 500 IOPS is the cap for a single virtual disk on a single virtual machine on Azure. If you want to do more, add more virtual disks and virtual storage space on top of that. But what I want to show you here quickly is a storage QoS policy centrally defined in VMM. Minimum IOPS of 200, max of 500 IOPS. Which is then applied to the virtual machines running on this soft cluster here. So I'm using disk speed to generate some workload here. And we see here performance monitor is measuring 500 something IOPS. And now I call my manager, hey, I did pay for this machine, I paid my whole salary, so I want to get 5,000 IOPS. Okay, storage admin gives me 5,000 IOPS right now. And what we see here, it should go up in a second, and we have 5,000 IOPS. Just as I change it, the policy manager recognizes the change and applies it to the virtual disk file. So easy as that.
And if you don't have 100,000 IOPS, so are there other virtual machines running, will there be something happening to guarantee your 5,000 IOPS? Will there be slowed down?
Yep. They will be capped down. And also, if I define a policy for virtual machines, let's say a minimum IOPS of 200 or 500 or 1,000 for each, and the storage system is not able to fulfill this requirement because of others requiring those IOPS, you will get a, let's say, policy is not compliant anymore. So we'll get an alert that virtual machine A does not get the IOPS which has been guaranteed at the minimum level. So reporting is a big issue now. It's solved in the next version.
Okay.
Now, this is huge. Storage space is direct.
Storage space is direct, right. So storage space is direct. Thank you. In 2012 R2, we have these chair JBots. So you have some JBots, and you connect them to the file server. What if you can use the storage in every file server and build a high available storage system? So in the moment, we have our directly connected systems to the JBots, and it's quite local because it's only in one rack because you have these ZAS connections. And you have to use ZAS devices in these shared JBots. You have to use ZAS HDDs, you have to use ZAS SSDs. So there is a rumor that ZAS SSDs are not so cheap. And SATA SSDs are not so expensive than the ZAS SSDs. So many people want to use SATA SSDs in this scenario. You can't use that in shared JBots.
Because they have to support SCSI persistent SCSI 3 reservations, so yeah, it's not possible. It's
and the devices are used for more than one server. They have to read and write to them. So like we talked about this hyperconverged thing, what if you have four file servers with local storage and you can build your high available storage system over these four file servers? And that's possible with Storage Spaces Direct. So let's see. We have no shared storage. The disks are in box. You can, of course, attach JBots to a single server, but this JBot is only used by the one server. So you can extend even your storage that is used by one server. If your server has maybe 12 disks, you can add another JBot and add 40 or 60 disks. But these disks are local to the one server. Then you have more servers. Microsoft introduced a software storage bus. So we have still this ZAS bus there that is used in the ZAS JBots, but it's a software storage bus. And now Microsoft can lay it over all servers and still do that ZAS thing to talk to every JBot and every disk. When you do Storage Spaces Direct, and we have more time to talk tomorrow because we have a special session about Storage Spaces Direct, your resiliency, maybe you have a three-way mirror. So if you have ZAS JBots, the ZAS controller is mirroring the data to the different disks. In a Storage Spaces Direct scenario, you have no ZAS controller. You have only your servers with the local disks, but you also want to have a mirror or two mirrors on other servers. So for that, you have to use Ethernet. You have to use the network. And we now have higher demands to the network that we use between the nodes. So Microsoft is now saying they use SMB3 for the mirroring of the disks, and you have to have very fast networks. So 10 gigabit is the minimum, and you have to have a low latency. So RDMA or SMB Direct is a requirement in the moment. Yep. So how does this setup look like? We have now here our storage nodes with local disks. This disk can be, of course, ZAS disks, but they can also be SATA disks or even new technology like NVMe disks. So flash disks directly connected to the PCI Express bus. That's possible with this scenario. And Klaus Jorgensen, he is responsible Microsoft program manager for this feature, blocked last week a scenario they did at some Intel event where they had 16 servers with NVMe disks, and they created over 2.5 million IOPS on this scenario. Yep. So my time is running out. What's here important?
Still 10 minutes to go.
Yeah, you can use the SATA disks and NVMe SSDs, and you have to have a fast network between the nodes. This scenario is very easy extensible. So if your four nodes are nearly full, you can add a fifth node with storage in it and extend your scenario. In TP2, the numbers were four nodes minimum, 12 nodes maximum. But Klaus Jorgensen also demonstrated past week, I think, 60 nodes. So there could be even more nodes. You can scale out a lot with a lot of this. On top of the software storage bus, everything is the same as in the scale-out file server. But you have local disks now. There is also another scenario, and we talked about the questions customers have. The hyperconverged scenario is possible with this Storage Spaces Direct scenario. It's on the next slide. So we have hyperconverged. We use directly, or we put directly our virtual machines on top of our nodes. And then we have the local storage, spread it over all hosts, and your virtual machines running on the same hosts. So Microsoft is, with Windows Server 2016, you will have hyper-converged, a hyper-converged scenario, with all the advantages and, of course, the disadvantages. So if you need more storage in such a scenario, you have to add another node with compute, because also virtual machines run there.
Okay, I can still the, let's say, the old-fashioned or scenario for larger enterprises, right?
Yeah, we can do that. That's another scenario here. We can do the disaggregated scenario, so we have our storage spaces direct. All the servers only deliver a scale-out file server with SMB, with file shares, and you have a separate or more than one separate Hyper-V cluster. You can even use a scale-out file server with single nodes. So it's possible to have more Hyper-V clusters or more Hyper-V machines using the same share. That's an advantage of SMB3. So these are the requirements for storage spaces direct. I think they are TP2.
TP2 layer. Yeah.
4 to 12 storage nodes. We have to have at least 10 gigabit RDMA networking between the nodes. This is for testing, I would say. You have to have one SSD. Normally, you have to have more SSDs because you also want speed in this scenario. And Microsoft has special scenarios or special vendor, I would say, configurations they support. So this is, in the moment, there is not the plan at Microsoft that you build up your own storage spaces direct cluster. You take some hardware there, some SSDs there and there. Microsoft learned from the experience with storage spaces, and they are now, in the moment, very limited what scenarios are supported. But the good news is there are already, I think, 7 vendors who have a setup with TP3. So there is Cisco there, Dell, Fujitsu, HP, Intel, Lenovo. And
you had your hands on Dell. I had mine on Quanta.
I have my hands on Dell, yeah. I will show you. So I will do the demo after the next session, because this is very important. Not many people know that. In Windows 2016, we will get something like storage rebalancing. So what is storage rebalancing? Let's first talk about Windows 2012 R2. We have a storage space scenario with Windows 12 R2. We have our disks there, and we use the disks. So the disks are filling up. So now you think, okay, I have in my scale-out file server, in my storage space, I have still slots left where I could put in disks, because now I need them.
I want to expand my storage spaces,
yeah.
Right?
We add another 4 disks in this example. So what do you assume? What is happening now? These disks are used for new data. There is nothing like shifting the blocks from one disk to another, rebalancing the blocks that are already there to the other disks. That's not happening. The new disks are only used for new data. You can create new virtual disks and use them. That's all. So also, if you have a defect disk, a disk is not working anymore, and you replace it, it's only used for new data, or it's like a hot spare. Yeah? In 2016, you can rebalance the stuff. So we have the same scenario. We have our disks here. They are used. And after a while, you add another 4 disks. And now you can rebalance the stuff. So there is a PowerShell commandlet that will do this work. You don't want to have the storage system doing when you add the disks. You want to do it maybe at night, because it's a very intensive operation.
And it's so damn simple. You just execute optimize dash storage pool, and the magic happens behind it.
Yeah.
So it's really easy.
So this scenario is useful, in my opinion, and there are, of course, more if you need more space in your storage spaces. But you can also remove devices. So if you have too much disk in there, you don't use all of them, and you want to use them somewhere else, you can pull out disks and do the storage optimization thing, and the data is put on the remaining disks. And even if you replace a defect device, it can be optimized and it is fully used. So every customer assumed that this is happening, but in 2012 R2 it's not. With 2016 we will get that feature. So now do I have a minute?
You still have almost 5 minutes for
your
demo.
Let me see. Oh. So can you switch? Uh-huh. So I have, like Michael told you, I have one scenario running in my company, and it's looking like that. It's a Dell setup, so I have four storage spaces direct nodes, and there are 12 HDDs in every server and four SSDs. And I did a setup with a hyperconverged scenario because you can't show hyperconverged. Where's my mouse? Here it is.
I saw it. It was there.
You have seen the
it's
mouse.
It's on the other
right?
screen.
Yeah, I know. I was so stupid to put TP3 on my notebook to show you, and it's not working well with different screens and so on. So I have to use this one. So what you see there is that's a mess. I think I have to postpone the demo to the other session because you can't do Windows P to say what screen you want to use. Let me see if I can see something here. No, it's not working that way. Sorry for that. We have to postpone the demo to the session.
Yeah,
but what you would see, I have 80 VMs running on this setup. All the four nodes are configured as hypervisor, and you can live migrate the VMs between the different nodes. And the storage is in every node, so you can turn off one node, and the VMs are started on another system, and so on. This is a hyperconverged scenario. It's running quite well, but I can't show it to you. So
I mean, we have 2 minutes left. Let's do a short recap what we have seen so far in storage coming up in 2016.
So you talked about
replica. Storage replica was a huge issue. It's still in projects where we have a requirement for synchronous replication because we don't have it right now. REFS is going to be a huge improvement in performance as well as resiliency level for your virtual machine and SQL workloads.
With storage costs, you now can control how much I/O your customers, your VMs will get, or even you can guarantee I/O for different VMs. And this is a distributed system, so everything is watched by the scale-out file server, even in the Hyper-V cluster. The Hyper-V cluster will know how much I/O is generated by which VM, and it's always looking, so I think it looks every 5 seconds how is the I/O and will distribute it like the policies are.
I mean, it's not just for guaranteeing SLAs if you're a service provider or a hosting provider. It's also, you don't want to buy tons of SSD storage just to fulfill the requirements of a fancy script, the admin, which is loading your storage with 10,000 of IOPS with just synthetic bullshit. So we want to have real workloads, and if you have real workloads, then you want to spread the possible IOs as good as possible to all the workloads running on top of your services, because you don't want to have a SQL server consuming 50,000 IOPS if it's not required. Maybe 10,000 would be sufficient. So you just reserve the capacity on a fair level for all your workloads. Yes. And it's really easy. Yeah. It's a rule of thumb. You create two policies and you're almost done.
So storage spaces direct. We think this is huge, even for a scale-out file server. You can add another node and use the storage with the local devices, with SSDs, with NVMe, with SATA SSDs. That's quite important. And even the hyper-converged scenario, in my opinion, if you are not an enterprise, you are maybe a, a medium shop, you have one or two of those clusters, and it's everything you need. And the storage rebalancing, this is a feature we needed in 2012 and 2012.2, but it's finally coming in 2016.
I mean, it's in fact required for Storage Space Direct, because if you add another node, you want to have the rebalancing occur, so all the nodes are, let's say, equally balanced with IOPS.
Please show the next slide. So we want to... Oh, this is hungry for more information about this stuff. We have the side session about Storage Spaces Direct, where we also will cover ReFS in depth, and you can ask questions. It's tomorrow in room Miami at 3:45. And we will have, this is not on your on your session agenda, there will be a Microsoft Private Cloud Q&A with Microsoft MVPs on Wednesday at 12:00, also in Miami. So this would be where you can ask questions about the infrastructure stuff. Please join us there. Michael will be there. Daniel will be there. I think Hans will be there. So we will be 5, 6, 7 MVPs, and you can ask questions. And we want also to thank our sponsors. You see that on that slide. And then we want to say thank you for being here in this session.
Please give your feedback. And this is really valuable to us to have your feedback on the sessions as well as for the whole conference, of course.
So,
and with that,
have a nice
thank you for your attention and have a nice lunch.